Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin. With guest co-host...
Mega Bears fan.
Are you putting your thumb somewhere where it shouldn't be?
Do you really want an answer to that question?
No, it's a metaphorical thing.
It's a metaphorical thumb? Oh, wow. Okay, well...
Okay, I'm not awake. I meant rhetorical. Sheesh. I meant... Oh. It's a rhetorical statement. There we go.
Show you a rhetorical thumb.
Hey, everybody. This is your host, Medjin, and this is Polycast episode 295. You are not where you need to be. You actually need to back down to Maine to where the fish and chips place is, go down the street to where Birch, take a left, go three houses down, and there you will see Dan's giant pile of forgotten top 10 lists. It's a wonderful thing. Joined today by Makalua.
Sorry, Makalua's brain is still not online. Please call back later.
The Mian Team.
Continuing to help you make responsible choices. Don't go to the top 10 list.
Mr. Dan Quick.
If these top 10 lists are so forgettable, how come you remember precisely how to get to them?
And joining us today is MegaBeFans.
Hitting the snooze button before the top 10 lists come.
Good move. It's not that they're unforgettable, Dan. It's that we would like to forget them, but we cannot.
It's because Madden took him out bat and dealt with him, and that's where he dumped him.
Ah, well.
Well, I do have to let people know where they are before, you know, things happen.
If you leave toxic waste just anywhere, it could be quite bad.
Yeah, it's a warning.
You need to start.
I forgot to put up a sign.
So, because you forgot to put up a warning sign, you decided to direct people where to go to find this supposed toxic pile of something?
Somebody will remember to put up a sign. Not my fault.
You're passing responsibility to our audience? Okay, I'm fine. Totally. I'm fine with this.
Well, that's the best thing to do. We need some feedback from the previous episode. Good amount, actually, ranging from just that our audio quality is better than usual, which, good job, I guess, Dan, to a couple of the finer points on chopping from Victoria. Victoria points out that the chop is both better and worse than explained, mostly in terms of early game practicality, when you can really get a ton of stuff out of cards like the 100% boat booster or walls. You know, you only get so many of those, and it's... not always something you want to be building, so trying to overflow on that's not going to really save you much production if you are investing in something you don't want anyway. Or Settler card is one that gets you more cities out more quickly early in the game. Let's see, I'm trying to summarize because it's a detailed post, and if you're interested in it, I would recommend just going and reading it because it's a decent number of words here, but I'm trying to take away the important stuff. So hopefully I don't miss anything.
Late game chop is the numbers for that. Victoria is pretty sure is a little ridiculous if you push science or culture. Basically, if you shove your way up through the tech and culture tree, then your chopping values are crazy, which is true. I mean, you can get a couple hundred from a chop, and if you want, say, Eiffel Tower, as you pointed out, just settle on a city in Tundra with a few trees and a couple builders, and then just chop it out.
There's also a point about making lumber mills or mines compared to the value of just chopping, which is interesting. This is true. Yeah. You do increase the cost of future builders, and then you don't have the charge for future chops. So depending on how you're doing.
Yeah, and she starts talking about it. If you can get 200 science by turn 100, just plausible, if you're really pushing it, then, you probably don't want mills and things because then you'll have to waste extra time undoing that just to chop it, other than the one. So it's kind of, the game can be heavily skewed, as per usual, to blast through trees and stuff like that.
Yes. Well, chopping has been favored since how many sieves ago? They allowed it, basically.
Yeah, and they've never really found a proper way to balance it so that you don't get crazy values out of it. And, of course, with overflow. Overflow combined with chopping.
In principle, it shouldn't be that hard to balance, though. Like, either you make the chop value less attractive, or you make the alternatives stronger, depending on the reason one or the other isn't viable.
Yeah.
But they just don't do it. contesting, they probably didn't see people blasting through the tech tree, and maybe they'll address that, and that will alter the utility consideration of the chop early versus not. But, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe there should be, like, a mid- or late-game technologies that actually buff just the underlying terrain instead of just resources and improvements. So maybe just as you go through the tech tree, forests and jungles could just become more productive as you get better and faster ways of chopping and of sustainably chopping.
Well, they did that in Civ 4, but the chop's usually still on.
Yeah,
again,
I mean,
that would help, because it would give you some incentive to keep them if they're strong, if that improvement is strong enough.
I mean, the ability to just plant a city and chop out late-game wonders, I mean, that's not really in the spirit of the game, per se.
It's not as ridiculous as the settler difficulties to force space races there. People want to put PCs by chopping out space parts, but it's in the similar conceptual territory.
I mean, yeah. If you left a bunch of forests around a city and said, okay, that's where I'm building my space parts, then, yeah, at the end of the game, you're going to have still a lot of forests and stuff that can all just get chopped and, whoops, into space.
And now that you mentioned, I wouldn't be surprised if the Civ 6 Hall of Fame scene has implemented something like that already for the low difficulties. If you look at the major tech boosts on the low difficulties, I'm assuming you do. I haven't actually tried it out, just playing Settler or whatever.
There's definitely something to be said when you're chopping and you've got overflow, the concept that, oh, we have all of this waste. We don't need to put all of this one-time production infusion into this particular construction, and we could save it or we could just throw it away. But then at the same time, as you're saying, what we've got right now, where it can just carry over into something else, and there's this incremental notion as the game goes on. So I think there has to be some kind of a limit to an overflow to me, number one. And number two, a little more emphasis on an absolute value in terms of the production that you're going to be getting out of, you know, the forest and the jungle as you chop. At some point in the game, it's more about the absolute value rather than the percentage. So you can't, as was mentioned on the last episode and comes up again, it's like, hey, let's chop to get spaceship parts or the infrastructure to get the spaceship parts, because it's one notion of ridiculous or another, which seems to be what the Civilization series does. And I would think at this point we've got enough evidence to suggest that one extreme or the other is not good. There's got to be a happy medium somewhere.
And it could easily just be in the math of the overflow, because Civ 6 tends to use boosted production rather than reduced cost, which does make sense to a point, so that you're not getting stuff out too fast. But where that intersects with a chop is that when you chop where you're using a policy card or something that'll give you a boost to what you're currently building, the rest of it overflows. So if you have like 5 hammers left on a wall and you're using the 100% wall policy card, then yeah, that full chop is getting doubled and then tossed into the next thing. And that's probably where they should look at making the fix, so that, yes, you can have these policy cards that boost out the thing you're currently building, but then it should only pull from the chop value enough to finish it, and then leave the rest as raw value.
How would we feel about just chopping not being applied to those production boosts from policies at all?
No, it should be applied, because you're doing something faster and you chose a policy card, so it should be affected by anything it would normally affect. But you could have a raw value of the chop and only apply as much of the production from it as needed to finish the item.
Yeah, that's what
and
I
then the
to do.
Then the rest would be still raw, and you wouldn't get crazy overflow out of using policy cards mixed with chopping.
Yeah,
you don't want to nerf the advantage of the policy cards too much.
Yeah.
And I definitely think that the overflow thing with that falls into the category of a bug. Rather, I can't imagine that's something that they deliberately sat down and said, hey, should overflow apply to something that you don't have the policy to buff? And somebody said, yes, it should. I can't imagine that's the case. So.
Yeah. No, I'd say less of a bug, and this falls more into the exploit category. It's not that they purposely did or didn't do it. It's just that it's the intersection of a couple of mechanics that no one thought about.
So, oversight they don't care about. Come on, this has been going on since Civ 4. I can't imagine they don't know that this happens. They just don't care.
I wouldn't say they don't care about it. Obviously, they changed policy cards from cutting in half with the policies in Civ 5 for reducing the cost versus switching to production boosters.
Specifically,
they did care
overflow,
to a point, but
overflow management, because their overflow management has been something that's kind of on the edge of sanity for ages. unless you're playing at a really high level, and I mean like in terms of player skill, not just difficulty level, it doesn't affect most people. I would imagine the percentage of their consumers that's meaningfully affected by this overflow stuff is relatively small. So I can understand them not wanting to prioritize this over quite a few other things. In fact, I would put this top 10 change on my top 10 change list, even close to it.
Mm.
But yeah, this has been up there for since I started playing Civ 4. So.
At least until it starts affecting games in the Civilization Olympics.
You know, even there, the game has enough problems from a competitive standpoint that this would not make top 10 on competitive either.
Yeah, maybe not.
Well, maybe. It'd probably get in there at that point.
I don't think it makes
if you're going pure competitive.
Because we have to do something about GG stacking and how the tech flows versus unit movement, defender versus attacker advantage. There's a lot of stuff when it comes to competitive that would affect every game much more significantly, in my mind anyway.
First off, I like the notion that Phil is compiling a top 10 list of his own, something else to add to Imagine's pileout.
That's right.
And second of all, I think about what you've been saying here, and Matt, that you had brought up that overflow only being applied to whatever it is that you're currently constructing, that chop in the card rather than the overflow into the next particular item. And that could also take into account, it's like, hey, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to chop this, but I currently don't have anything in my production queue.
Yeah.
Well, that was pretty stupid, because now with this specifically in place, then you're not going to get that added benefit from the card because you weren't smart enough to say, like, okay, we need to rush this. Well, what are we rushing? We brought all of this production from the forest or from the jungle, or heck, even if we're still, you know, like harvesting stone or something like that, we brought all of this here to construct something, but there's nothing to construct. So in that particular point in time, then that kind of momentum is lost. But at the same time, so long as I would like to see the production queue back, but it's like, oh, well, if I put something in the production queue, then it's already got something else called up, so I don't have to worry about it not overflowing. That, no, whether we have a production queue or not, whether you've got anything in the production queue or not, it's only that specific item that you have that you can that kind of double over on that overflow.
Oh, although Victoria mentioned that, because somebody actually asked if it's you lose all chop production if nothing is in the queue. The specific situation in that case is if it's on your turn, you finish the production in the previous turn, then you chop that turn before selecting something. That's slightly different than you chopped, finished something, and then tried to leave the city empty to go to the next turn, which is, I think, where Victoria was going with that, with her comment. So two slightly different sections, and then there's a little confusion of if that actually exists or not. I'm pretty sure it doesn't.
This might sound way too complicated, but maybe we just need, like, a separate bucket for chop production.
Yeah.
So chop production would just go into that bucket, and then whenever you're building something, it would just pull from that bucket, and then that second bucket could maybe even have, like, a cooldown or something applied to it to prevent someone from just, you know, repeatedly chopping one turn after the other and rushing things.
Or sending 8 builders to sit on 8 forests and... popping that wonder.
Yeah.
Instant wonder.
I don't know. I don't think we need to fully see this. I have to agree. I think just Mad's suggestion would make it a reasonable mechanic.
Yeah. I mean, you got to keep in mind, it needs to be functionally viable to still be a mechanic. At some point, you put too many constraints on it, and it stops being useful, even for common stuff.
Right. Well, elsewise, from episode 294, there was also the topic about recurring consumer spending, and Candace Albanis, who was a guest on that episode, replied to this thread, saying some of the stuff I said about ongoing consumer spending should be taken into specific context. Specifically, the episode was recorded before the Electronic Arts Battlefront fiasco, and the kind of stuff they were doing cannot be defended in good faith. I consider myself to be rightly put in my place. Thank you.
That was special, that whole thing.
Although it came from the company we would expect.
Yes. It's not a surprise who it was. It's a surprise they actually did it.
Playing the devil's advocate and, you know, just arguing, making the games are getting more expensive argument. I just, in general, don't really buy that argument to begin with. There's a whole lot of other things that game developers and game publishers are doing to reduce costs. You know, they're using a lot of game engines and middlewares from off the shelf that save a lot of costs, and a lot of games are sequels and stuff like that where they're reusing code. You know, I guarantee you EA is not rewriting Madden from scratch every year. Activision rewriting Call of Duty, nor is Ubisoft rewriting Assassin's Creed from scratch. And now more and more publishers at least are shifting towards digital distribution, which means they're not having to spend money on manufacturing and packaging and distributing the product. and for the companies that have their own digital storefront, like EA with Origin, assuming anybody actually ever buys anything off of Origin, they're keeping 100% of the money and not having to share it with the retailer. So there's a lot of...
They also have to pay for the upkeep of Origins.
Yeah, but that's probably a much smaller cost than splitting profits with, you know, Target and Walmart and Best Buy.
And producing this stuff.
I mean, I don't have the number, but there's a lot of other things that these companies are doing to cut costs that make it so that these games are not prohibitively expensive to manufacture and produce. Because if they were, they wouldn't be making them to begin with at all.
Well, to a point. They have to make money. It just depends on how much money they're making.
Right, but if they were really losing money on every game that they made, then...
Oh, yeah, they'd be out of business. Well, then, it's time to lose your religion.
Thanks, R.E.M.
Mm-hmm. Another thread by Victoria, spreading my religion. She's looking to work on the spread mechanic. Trying to figure it out, apparently. Obviously, with the most latest patch, some things have adjusted from previous, i.e. trade routes helping with passive spread. Straight-up conversions, obviously you have trait conversions where you send missionaries and apostles to go troll people, or inquisitors just to sit there and cleanse stuff. But, and then you have that passive spread where you have multiple cities hanging out in them, pushing along. So, based on conversion, a city will be converted once more than or equal to. I think it's technically more than, because if you have six pop in a city and say... two and two are different religions, and then the other two are nothing, or pantheons, and whichever one was there first is still the one in control. Ish. Because you can always hit that negated spot. Anyways, get converted. Conversion of cities pop appears to be based on accumulation of pressure over time. Ish. 50 pressure points to convert one pop of an atheist, 100 pressure points to convert one pop of a religious city, and 200 pressure points to convert one pop of a holy city. Yeah, generally, holy cities have their own pressure and local pressure where they will fight off conversions. So, might not actually take more pressure points specifically to convert one pop in a holy city, but it could be that for each turn that you try to apply pressure, the holy city is also removing pressure, so it kind of sums up eventually out to around 200 points or so. Assuming, that, of course, that you're getting more pressure on that city than the holy city is getting from other sources. Because if it's getting more, you're not going to convert anybody. There are lots of modifications around pops and whether or not they're atheists or pantheon people. And there is some local pressure. If a city has a holy site, it's going to pressurize cities within the area. So speaking of which, a city with a majority religion will passively spread that religion to other cities within 10 hexes. So city with no holy site, one pressure per turn, also very likely to be pressurized since it has no actual defenses. City with a holy site, about two pressure per turn. And the holy city, including Jerusalem, if you happen to be the Caesarian of it, four pressure per turn. Trade route to a city will give you that extra 1 point of pressure, but also feeds back half a point of pressure of the other one. Which, if it happens to be the same religion, then you can boost both cities to purge out the infidels. And, of course, scripture beliefs will boost out 25% and 50% after printing. And a city itself does not apply pressure on itself. Well, that's not really quite true. Holy cities definitely do, because they need to be able to purge the annoyance out of their own territory.
The holy status is pretty much like a separate consideration, though, right?
Yeah. But, you know, in the normal passive spread, yeah, city won't pressure itself, because that would be weird. But the holy city status will definitely affect. So that's only one city out of all of them. And, of course, you have your activated pressures. So missionaries, apostles, inquisitors, gurus, warrior monk. Religious unit gets wiped within 10 hexes of a city. Those cities lose 150 pressure of that religious unit's type. So if there's nothing there, it doesn't really bother them. So, you know, you can kill off a Catholic apostle within 10 hexes of a city that doesn't have any Catholicism. It doesn't care. And, of course, an apostle with translator promotion triples the spread strength in foreign cities. That's your active. And then you have what she didn't write down was the little specials, which was apostles with that wonderful, wonderful religious nuke ability will slaughter all Well, it no longer slaughters everybody of different religions.
75%. That got fixed. I
think. Yeah, got fixed down to 75%, but still,
darn.
The religious nuke is still strong in that one. But that one completely ignores the pressure concept, so probably why it wasn't listed in that active pressure, because it's just like, how many of you are here? Okay, get out.
Yeah. It's important to remember that it's there, just in case you're having trouble with a particular city, though, and you get that rolled up, and then you can just walk right in and go, nope.
Yep, or if somebody founds a religion after you've started spreading into their cities, it's like, nope, I can use you to nuke three cities, and no more religion for you. And then just use follow-up missionaries to boost up your religion. Of course, there's the religious lens. The only real point in the religious lens is to show off the UI visuals. This is a holy city. It has three rings around it. This is a holy site. It's got two, and slightly different than the normal city, which has one and a bit. You can see very quickly whether or not it's got a holy site or it's the holy city versus just a normal city. So, and of course, you have now with the new religious lens, the direction of pressurization. So you can see finally who's providing pressure to what and where it's going. So you don't have to always wander around going, okay, so why is this dropping? Or my city's not getting converted by my own religion. Why? Now you know.
Because that city's producing a stupid amount and I need to go kill it.
Yep. And apparently the text will pulse with when six turns or left or below are left on the conversion. So if you're going to have somebody converted, you'll have some flashy lights.
Yeah, it'll flash your light for a couple of turns, and the pressure will change, and it'll go back the other way. And you're sitting there looking at it, I thought that was supposed to convert in two turns.
Yep.
That happened a few times.
Then there's a big old question about Jerusalem and the rest of the text. Jerusalem, if you give it a religion, with no one being the Caesarian of it, will still generally act like a normal city for pressure. But, of course, the moment somebody becomes Caesarian, it automatically flips over and goes boom, becomes a holy city. That's why, if you're not playing religion, or Jerusalem is right next to you, you just kill it.
No Jerusalem for you.
Jerusalem is best used if it's not on your continent, and you went for a religion.
Mr. Radar in the thread says, Jerusalem can be of help if it is deep in enemy territory and is surrounded by smaller cities as they can be converted faster, but if it is somewhere on the outskirts, its value drops. It is unworthy to untie the straps of the sandals of Yerevan if the latter is present on the map. This baby is your typical madman super weapon, and with no design flaws, it is the ultimate Death Star with no stupid ventilation shafts, quote-unquote. So,
Death Star with no ventilation shafts. That's an interesting one.
So just to confirm here for people listening, Jerusalem, it'll automatically convert to the religion you founded, and it exerts pressures for that religion as if it were a holy city, whereas with Yerevan, your apostle units can choose from any of their possible promotions instead of receiving a random promotion, again, of course, if you are their suzerain, and for as long as you are their suzerain.
So you can have an army of religious nukes. See ya.
I mean, what?
Yep. Or, I mean, obviously, you send your religious nukes surrounded by a bunch of debaters, just in case.
Yeah, that works too.
Send the debaters in first. They will have discussions and words with those evil, foul people so that they can get out of the way of the religious nuke.
And now, thanks to the fall 2017 patch, you can also bring along some gurus so you don't have to go back to holy sites to repair your religious combat units.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Raider also notes that you want to have some sweet pairs of proselytizers and translator, where religious spread is triple strength in cities of other civilizations, including city-states.
But to be more specific and sort of summed up by Victoria in her last post, pressure passively is very weak in this game compared to, say, Civ 5. Civ 5 was all about the passive pressures, whereas Civ 6 is definitely all about the active. There is passive pressure in Civ 6, but it takes a huge backseat to the active side. So don't get too focused on the passive pressure. Just keep it in mind. It's there, but it's not going to really win you a game or help.
Well, there's this thing called the theocracy government that will reduce the cost of purchasing religious units. There's the Huggable Sophie, Hagia Sophia. These people are wondering, I'm sorry, wait, what's this now? What kind of podcast is this? Give your missionaries and apostles an additional charge. And, of course, there's picking the religious building mosque, granting your missionaries and apostles an additional charge again, which also increases their effectiveness by 50% when spreading the religion. So you just stack all of these on top of one another, and you could win really quickly, you know, before that person that's trying to win domination runs you over. Better hurry up. Speaking of hurrying up, actually, that's not a bad segue, given what's been suggested here.
Yeah, speaking of hurry up, hey, great athletes. Did we need those? I don't know. But God of Kings is proposing a new type of person called a great athlete. Of course, you recruit them using gold or great athlete points. The points would come from arenas and stadiums, which would give you a better reason for building entertainment complexes. They're simply sacrificed for gold and amenities.
Why would you spend gold to get gold unless you get more money from that, and then you just always do it?
I know. It's a nice list so far. I mean, even if it's a little American biased.
Just a smidge.
Yeah. A lot of the conversation in that thread so far has been, so who could these great athletes be? Question mark. But also God of Kings adds a little later on, but with the policy cards for great athlete point generation, it could include collegiate sports for +2 great athlete points per turn and development league for +4 points per turn. He also mentions Brazil and the United States specifically modifying their civilization abilities based on this. Now, the Brazil is just kind of an extension of the ability they already have. Brazil can have +1 great athlete point per street carnival per turn. Mm. But he also suggests that the United States can have +1 great athlete point per campus per turn to, quote-unquote, reflect the popularity of collegiate sports.
Mm.
Which I'm thinking in and of itself, yes, but that's not just the United States.
Well, website in the U.S., we get a little U.S.-centric, it happens.
True. Now, there was one person, actually a couple of people, but first Anonymous Speed that are like, nope, 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 I really don't like this idea. I don't see a function put forth which would make them unique or otherwise be able to do things other great people can't already do. I also don't see how this additional incentive to build entertainment complexes would really change the gameplay all that much. Unless the great athletes themselves can do something interesting, I don't see what advantage there is to giving entertainment complexes a great person type.
Yeah.
Furthermore, it has to be a pretty darn good type of great person to incentivize people to divert resources from campuses, commercial hubs, and industrial zones.
Yeah, I'm kind of not terribly keen on the athlete idea, but I do think it might be interesting to have actual sporting events that you, like, plug into your arenas and stuff. You know, similar to how you would attach a specialist to a building in previous versions of the game. You know, you could have, like, baseball or football or soccer or something like that, and you could play that sport in your stadium or whatever, or arena for varying bonuses, and then, like, maybe export them almost like resources, and that have some kind of cultural influence on other civilizations. That, I think, could maybe be a more interesting system than athletes, and then that could be expanded to other things as well, like maybe getting, like, animals to put in zoos and things like that as well, that could have varying effects.
Seeing some similarities to what Scrum Lord suggested, which was we could instead add citizen slots to entertainment complexes with certain buildings and also extend existing social policies to change what type of great person points entertainment citizen generates. So, for example, you could adopt this particular policy within the entertainment complex and you could get an additional great scientist point or engineer point or merchant point, et cetera, et cetera. And as you were describing a sporting event, I was thinking back to the World Congress and in Civilization V, and
we had an Olympic Games.
Yeah, the Olympic Games, yes. But something that was more civilization-based specifically and something that could be recurring as opposed to a one-time thing. Yeah, I could see that. Something more incremental and not where it was really winner takes all, but winner took proportionately a lot, and then it was here and it was gone again, and it came a little later in the game as well. This is something that you could be building towards and accumulating throughout the game, just like great person points for most other types of great people. And then there was also the notion from Anonymous Speed that I don't really think athlete fits with the other categories. Athletes can temporarily impact cultural identities, true. However, they ultimately don't have nearly the same impact on civilizations as the other categories. So Amron Rill later on said, well, how about just a great entertainer category instead, which could include but not be limited to great athletes. But then someone was pointed out, but we already have great musicians, for example, so and that's an entertainer. So now aren't we just overlapping things? And then maybe that gets into expanding what we already have in terms of not so much the great people notion, but something that you can be doing more with the entertainer complexes, and how maybe that could be kind of a catch-all basin for some additional incremental great person point generation.
Yeah, there isn't much of a distinction between, like, the different writers, artists, and musicians in this game. I kind of think that it might be better to just put those all back in one bucket, and then maybe have, like, a system where when you pick a great person or when you recruit a great person, like, it gives you, like, maybe three or something like that different great people to choose from, and then you pick which one you want. And then, you know, a new one gets put in that place for the next person to pick. And then, so that way you could choose whether you want a writer, an artist, or a musician. And then we could throw in, you know, some of these other things as well, like athletes and entertainers and later in the game, things like movie directors and stuff like that, that don't really fit comfortably already into one of those three categories.
Yeah, that could work.
And we wouldn't always be seeing exactly what's on the menu for the next great person of whatever type and, you know, like trying to beat the AI to it. We're going to have a random draw of three possibilities. We don't know what we're going to get, so that keeps it a little mysterious.
Yeah, well, and that would actually also help with some of the great person stuff that's already in the game. For example, we've already got the great artists where they've got a million different types of art that they create, and, like, you need specific types of arts for different theming bonuses. And there's only, like, two or three sculptors in the entire game, so it'd be kind of nice if they would just give you a choice of which one you want, small list, like I said, like maybe three things, and then you pick one. So if you are specifically trying to theme sculptures, then when you see one of those guys show up as one of the three choices, you'd want to put emphasis on getting to them, as opposed to there just being one person, and you can only get that one person, and you have no idea who's going to be next. I think it would make it a lot easier to do some of the more great person and art theming and stuff like that, things that are already in the game that right now are kind of just a crapshoot as far as, you know, I've seen.
Well, and it could be an opportunity to give the great musicians a little bit more, great writers a little bit more flavor, because I remember earlier this year when we were ranking great people and the individual great people and comparing them, it was just kind of like, well, a great writer is a great writer and a great musician is a great musician and a great artist is a great artist, because there really is nothing distinctive based on these particular individuals. And some of the stuff that has come up in this thread has not only been these are the different individuals, but these are also the effects that they could have. And maybe that could be part of a greater effort to revisit those existing great people and give them some other variation other than the era that they're most likely to appear in or would definitely appear in. Yay, variety.
Yeah, or alternatively, if each of the great works had some unique effect when you slotted it into a place, that could also satisfy that need. That might be getting overly complicated, but that would be another way to do that same sort of thing. I definitely do think there's a lot of room to expand the current great person system. It's one of the things that I've been kind of disappointed with the game in general so far.
Rule of thumb for evaluating trade yields, yes, still in Civilization VI, thread started by Softly. I find myself using the following rule of thumb for comparing trade yields to different locations. One production, equaling one culture, equaling 1.25 science, equaling two faith, equaling three gold. Wondering if everyone else has something similar. Remember, this is a rule of thumb, so assume a veil of ignorance and you don't know the civilization, era, victory condition, or the city needs. Food is far too situational to meaningfully be included in this. And I couldn't help but think,
That's interesting.
Yeah, I'm thinking, but what makes that so contextual when evaluating the trade yields are things like the civilization and the era and the city needs and, by extension, the terrain. Maybe not necessarily victory condition, but that's in there as well.
There's only one real victory condition anyway. It's okay.
Oh, I thought you were going to say there's only one real important yield, and that's gold, which isn't that far off. I mean, there are other important yields as well, but we know gold is king, and that did come up again in this thread. But Empress Kiova says, it depends on what I want to achieve. I like having high gold yields and having lots of different small yields instead of something like +3 food and +3 production, unless that city is still developing, of course, in which case food is king. But ISU also says, I don't think a linear comparison is possible between trade yields. He says, food and hammers are local yields. They have tremendous swing value depending upon the food and hammers already available to a city. culture is both a local and global yield, because culture contributes to grabbing land tiles, which is more of an issue in early in the game than later once most tiles are already claimed, whereas gold, faith, and science are global yields. The output of the home cities doesn't impact decision-making, just whether you are lagging one of those areas in the global sense. The real question with these yields is, for me, do I need that thing more than supporting the local yield of a young city? Gold in particular can be tricky with regards to this question, because although it is a global yield, it allows gold purchases of buildings which can contribute to local effects. I think, yeah, it really does come down to those local effects are going to have an impact on what your city can do. And it kind of goes back to, why am I settling this city right now? How am I going to be specializing it? Is it more about the food? Or at least right now, is it going to start off at food and then I get to a certain point, a certain number, and I'm satisfied with that? Okay, the city is large enough. It can now support a decent output for science and gold, in part because it's grown large enough so that I can construct another district, and now I can construct those buildings in those districts because there's decent production for that. And then it's getting more production if it's an industrial zone, or I'm looking for some kind of additional cultural output, so I can construct those buildings. But then there's also the gold generation, so I could be turning around and be buying some of those buildings as well, just not buying gold with gold, as we've talked about before. So really, the rule of thumb for evaluating trade yields is, yes, what do I want to do? What do I want to do right now? And it doesn't necessarily mean that the value isn't important later on. It's just that if I'm not going to be benefiting from that city's construction right now, then I should be prioritizing settling somewhere else or doing something else, and then go and grabbing that location to then decide, okay, all of these things in balance, how am I actually going to progress? And I guess this also precludes the idea that you're actually going for a victory condition. Or at the very least, just, you know, trying not to die. I think Amtrak Quebec's comment is the best, though, because it's kind of the meta response. My only rule of thumb is never to put my thumb somewhere where it isn't wanted. Well, that's good for any part of your hand or other parts of your body, really, when you think, stop and think about it. And now you're stopping and thinking about it. UW Habs talks about it varies too much by situation to have a general rule. But he says early game before a Pantheon, getting that first faith is big. Yes, talked before about on this show that I'm not interested in founding a religion, but I am interested in founding a pantheon, so yes. And now usually that faith generation comes from the God King policy card, but it doesn't necessarily have to come from that. But UW Hab says that once that pantheon drops, I basically stop caring about faith until much later on when I start seeing what I can do with it, which is also mentioned on the show. To me, that would be rushing great people. Better conversion than with gold. Plus, there's other things I'd like to do with the gold. And then depending upon the game, I can either value faith as equal to the other yields or virtually zero. And in a general game, I value science versus culture. It basically depends on how much of each I'm getting. If I'm lucky and I get enough culture from city-states like Kumasi, where your trade routes to any city-state provide +2 culture and +1 gold for every specialty district in the origin city, or Nan Madal, your district's honor next to coast tiles provide +2 culture, then I might value science more. And well, if you're talking about culture and you're talking about city-states, don't forget about Antananarivo, which gives you extra 2% culture for every great person ever earned.
We now have Sid Meier's Civilization and New Dawn, because in case you wanted to play Civilization in your real life with all your friends.
Particulars were discussed on episode 290, which was published in September, although it was recorded for episode 288 the month before. Because of that, I went looking for a review, and seeing as how it just came out, I'm thinking, well, even though it just came out yesterday, if I could find a gaming site, they've probably had the copy for a while, so that when the game was released and it was okay, you can actually drop your review now, that it would appear. But I only found one, but the one that I found gave me a greater appreciation for what it was actually like to play the game, particularly when it wasn't coming from publisher marketing department. It's like, okay, you say this is fantastic, and you can do all of these things, but how fun is doing these things? How do these things interact with one another? Because the idea with Civilization the New Dawn was inspired by Civilization VI. So I'm thinking, okay, so you want to do Civilization VI, like things in a board game? Setup is only going to take like an hour and a half. And then, okay, that was fun, guys. That's a great game setting it up.
I obviously can't speak to A New Dawn because the game like just came out this weekend. I haven't picked it up yet, let alone had a chance to play it. But I do have quite a bit of experience with the previous Sid Meier's Civilization board game by Fantasy Flight. And I will say that I very much enjoy it, and all the friends that I've played it with who also play the Civilization computer game have very much enjoyed it. Did do a pretty good job of translating most of the core mechanics of the game into board game form. And, yeah, setup is kind of a problem, like you said, but if you're pretty good about organizing everything, then it's a lot quicker. It can be reduced to, like, 10 minutes, if that. It is a pretty good game, and I'm actually really looking forward to trying out A New Dawn.
So I just wanted to pull just a few things from the review, seeing as how our audience is not Civilization board game players, but Civilization computer game players. What are kind of those comparable things that make you think these kind of initial questions, even if I don't want to go and purchase it, if I knew somebody that had purchased it, or perhaps maybe a group of people that you knew in your real life thought, well, maybe if we pull our money together, then you'd be willing to try it. But what is the experience like? The thing that really caught my attention was not the comment about how quickly it was to set the game up, but that it could, quote, be taught in under 10 minutes, especially once a round is demonstrated. And Jason, you had mentioned that with the Civilization the board game from Fantasy Flight Games, which I do have, and as I've only taken it out of the shrink wrap, I've yet to find anybody to play it. What was the learning curve more than 10 minutes?
The learning curve is a little bit steep, but as you just said, the best way to teach the game is you don't bother trying to read a 60-page rulebook. You're not going to be able to read the rulebook to everybody and expect them to keep up, and even doing that by itself would probably take like half an hour, 40 minutes. The best way that I've found to teach these, and not just the Civilization board game, but like other large epic games like this, is you basically just set up a game round, and then you just let everyone just play, and as it gets to their turn, just tell them some of the things that they can do. Just play through a round or two, and then at the end of those two rounds, say, all right, is everyone comfortable with the game? If so, do you want to keep playing this game, or do we want to just reset up and start again and play for real? You know, one of the beautiful things about the Civilization computer game in general is that it starts very small and gets more complicated from there. So you start the game with just very few mechanics and systems that you need to worry about, and then the new mechanics and systems are gradually added to the game as you play. And the Fantasy Flight board game had a lot of that, too.
Yeah, I think the biggest obstacle for me would be get those other two or three other players.
Yeah.
Because I don't want anybody in my real life that plays Civ, and a lot of people know that I play Civilization, but they probably wouldn't even sit there and watch me play the game, you know, by myself. So
yeah, that is the problem. I definitely hope to get A New Dawn and to play it, and after I get a few games in, I'll definitely be writing a review on my blog.
In general, when we're talking about any kind of board game, whether it's this Civilization board game, Fantasy Flight 1 before that, one thing that we do talk about on this show is trying to, if you want to understand the mechanics and things being behind the hood, that you're going to have to go into the code to try to figure out because it's not documented well. On this panel, in terms of regular co-host, Phil is probably the champion of that, bringing that up. I don't really think that's so much of an issue in a board game because unless you're doing in-house rules, you're going to have to figure out what exactly is going on in order to take your turn, let alone who's actually going to win. You don't have to worry about, oh, I don't know what this value is, but I'm just going to go ahead and play the game anyway and try to figure it out. So I would think for people like us who want to know those things up front, or at least be able to refer to them up front, that would be an advantage to a board game version of Civ.
Yeah, there's definitely nothing going on under the hood that you can't see happening in a board game.
I don't know how.
Other than the AI logic for the other players you're playing against, yeah, everything is going to be exposed to the player.
Pretty tough to hide the roles there, yes.
At least if you're trying to make a good board game. If you're trying to make a really bad board game, I guess you could probably just not publish half the rules in the rule book and see how people do.
Yeah, totally.
Just make up the rules as you go, I guess. What else could you do in that case?
Exactly. With Civilization, A New Dawn, the board game, I'm just looking for key terms that relate to our understanding in Civilization VI. So there are aspects of your civilization that you can control. Specifically, there are specific cards for culture, science, economy, industry, and military. These cards are then placed under a focus bar, and this bar contains 5 slots, one for each card, which are both numbered and reference specific terrain types. A focus card then is placed in a row that determines its strength, and it generates either a flat value or dictates where on the map an action can be made. All of these tokens and all of these plastic figures governed by the terrain, And the slot number stipulates, for example, how far to advance a technology dial to unlock new focus cards that can replace existing ones. So we've got the different elements that we think of in terms of Civilization VI, those parts of your empire management that you have to manage. Plus, oh, there is the concept of a technology tree. I didn't see any reference to something that would be the equivalent of a civics tree. But when it comes to victory conditions, it's all about completing objectives. You'll randomly draw 3 out of 5 victory cards. Every card has 2 agendas on it, and the goal is to complete 1 from each. Quote, most aren't inherently violent, unquote. And I thought, aw. But then again, if you're playing with people in real life, you can have other types of violence, I suppose, with players that are outside of the game.
Yeah, one of the... One of the rules in the Fantasy Flight game is that there's a concept of non-binding agreements, and during the diplomatic phase of the game, you can offer trades to other people, and within the game rules, you are allowed to exchange things that are not enforceable via game mechanics, and you're not obligated to actually follow through on those promises. So, for example, Dan, if you and I were playing, I could be like, hey, Dan, if you don't attack me on this turn, I'll buy you a beer. Like, that's allowed within the game rules.
Totally.
Of course, if I don't buy you a beer, then you're probably not going to trust me next game.
Well,
that's
also a pretty vague. See, I would never agree to that, Jason, because first off, you didn't specify the timeline for purchasing Nevis beverage.
Yeah, but natural light.
You're annoying me, huh? All right, well, then you would probably do well at the diplomacy in the Civilization board game. You wouldn't fall for ploys like that.
You didn't talk about the brand of alcohol. You didn't talk about the size. You didn't talk about the condition of the container and how it would be delivered and who would be delivering it.
Yeah. There are plenty of opportunities for outside of game violence to occur.
You still owe me that beer.
It's in the mail.
Oh boy.
And since you have experience with the Fantasy Flight version, like I said, I own it. And it looks nice on the shelf. That's really what it's doing. And yes, for people who are listening to the show, you may or may not have heard that, yes, I've engaged. My fiance and I, we purchased a home. And yes, the box is actually on display in the basement. It's fantastic. I'm not sure how I got away with it. And I don't know how long I'll be able to get away with it. But yay me.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. The description of Civilization and New Dawn, in terms of the combat, came up, and again, this article was written by Christopher Keese over at GameRanks. The only part of the game I was initially cool on was combat with other players. Attacks are made from friendly static spaces, your cities or control tokens, and how strong they are is dependent on the military card's focused row position, any bonuses provided by trade tokens or other cards, and then a dice roll. If you have a higher number, you win. Oh. Just the phrasing, I'm like, so there's the random number generator in there. That's fantastic. Yeah, it sounds like a basis for a little house rule there that just a dice roll claims all. I'm like, oh. I mean, Christopher describes this as not particularly exciting, and I'm thinking, I could see my reaction being particularly exciting, actually. But he does say that the game is not necessarily a game of prolonged military encounters. I'm thinking, well, if he's acknowledging that most of the victory conditions aren't inherently violent, then it sounds like they're trying to de-emphasize that anyway. I guess my question is, in the Civilization, the board game version from Fantasy Flight, where does the roll of a dice that's just kind of the random number generator equivalent come into play, if at all, combat or otherwise? Because that, for me, would probably start driving me nuts.
It actually sounds like this might be a reactionary thing to the older Fantasy Flight game. A lot of people criticized it for being a little bit too aggressive and militaristic. The group of friends that I typically play the game with all happen to be a lot of turtle players, so we almost always end up deciding our games with science victory, but according to the forums, the science victory is the one that never wins. It's always supposed to be culture or military or something like that. But with regard to the actual question of randomness, in the old game, there were no dice at all. Randomness came in the form of the map generation. There were different tiles, and you put the tiles randomly face down on the board, so every time you play, the map is a little different. And then in actual combat, the way that it worked was you had army figures that were on the board, little plastic flags, and you moved them around, and when they met on the battlefield, you would draw a hand of unit cards. And the unit cards had different strength and defense values, and you would play them against each other in kind of like a war kind of thing. But there was also a paper-rock-scissors relationship where an infantry would trump a cavalry would trump a ranged would trump infantry. Basically, the way that worked is just that the unit that trumps the other unit does its damage first, and if it kills the other unit doesn't get to attack back. So it was like a first strike kind of thing. The randomness all just came in the draw of the cards. So you would buy units, and they would go into a draw deck, and then when you actually fight, you would draw a subset of your unit cards and play those. So that was where the randomness would come from. But it was only like plus or minus 1 point of strength or health, usually, for any given card. So it wasn't much variety, but there were times where you would just draw crap unit cards and would not be able to win any battles at all unless you had a bunch of other modifiers that gave you bonuses.
Well, to me that certainly sounds better than just it ultimately being decided by a dice roll, that there's a number. There's not the, okay, you're going to random, oh, I pulled out this card, but then you've also randomly pulled out that card, and then there are known game rules from the outset that then determine the outcome of that,
right.
As opposed to, oh, I rolled a 3 and you rolled a 2, I win, and that takes precedence over everything else, and there's no connection to the design of the game at all. That's better.
It sounds like most of the strategy involving military in this newer game is going to be focused on building up all your bonuses and buffs and stuff like that in order to minimize the effect that the dice will have on the combat. So hopefully it's not like Risk combat where you literally just have both players roll a die and whoever rolls the largest number wins. So I would guess it's probably going to be a 6-sided die. Again, I haven't played the game, so I can't say one way or the other.
Well, if you and the other players in Civilization New Dawn are taking all of these bonuses by the trade tokens and the other cards, and you set yourself up otherwise, plus you know that at some point when there's the actual test of all of these things, it's going to come down to a die roll, that you have just as much of a chance to get luck screwed as somebody else, that be prepared to lose and perhaps lose often militaristically, but that doesn't necessarily then going to equate you to losing the game because you've given yourself that buffer and you've thought about when that could happen and how that could happen and how bad it could be. All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
In conclusion, here to our look at Civilization: A New Dawn being released, there are 16 dual-sided map tiles. There's an event dial and direction token that randomize the movement of barbarians. They don't talk about barbarians at all, but I went, wait, what? I didn't read about that before. There are 8 leaders that are included, each with different abilities. And apparently there are also world wonders in the game that come into effect in some way. So I'm certain we'll be seeing more accounts of this on the interwebs as people get to play the game and we get more quote-unquote player reviews that are not attached to any specific website, and also websites like GameRanks that come in with their own reviews.
I will be vacating my position here on Polycast to make way for somebody who's a little bit more passionate about the game, because I am definitely not, and it just seems kind of unfair to leave Dan with somebody who doesn't really want to pay attention to the content of the Polycast, i.e. Civ. I'm kind of done with Civ at this point. It's only fair to allow Dan to have somebody else step in and take over the position with a bit more passion than I can muster at the moment.
To that end, segueing into who Madryn's replacement on the panel is going to be, why, that would be somebody that you've also listened to on this episode, and that would be Jason. Mega Bears Fan Grade is the new 4th regular co-host of Polycast, which, yes, in part of this announcement is also that Polycast is coming back in 2018 for a 12th season, and now Mega Bears Fan is going to be away until March due to some family commitments. So what's going to be happening in January and February is we're going to have a couple of guests on the episodes in January and February. Going to try to prioritize having some more returning favorites as we get started in the new season. But Jason, welcome to the Polycast regular panel.
Thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here. It's always great to talk to you guys. Mad, I'll try not to burn the place down.
Sorry, too late.
Well, I'll try not to make this dumpster fire any worse.
No, I think what Madryn is saying is don't interfere with the fire I've already set.
are you burning all the bridges? Every one of them?
Oh, I guess I don't know. If anybody's thinking about it, I'm no longer part of the Civ team either. Little detail there. And you probably won't see any Civ videos on my YouTube channel either. Not that I have.
Moving on to other games, is there something else that we can expect to see content?
Oh, yeah. I've got a variety of stuff I'm going for. I just need something different. It's just I don't foresee Civ providing the challenge to me specifically that it used to, or the entertainment. So I need something different that will provide me with those two items.
Imagine during the Polycast regular panel in July of 2012. So myself, Mackie, Phil, and Matt. We have been the four regular co-hosts for almost 5.5 years, which is a record for the show. And quite frankly, if you look at any podcast that has gone more than 200 episodes, and a lot of podcasts that go more than 200 episodes, the vast majority are also weekly shows, I challenge you to find first that have four regular co-hosts, number one, and then to find one that had four regular co-hosts that were with the show for this length of time. So very much appreciate the stability, but we also very much appreciate, on behalf of myself, Mackie, the Meehan team, all of our guest hosts and all of our listeners, the years that you have been on the show, Matt. And I know you mentioned not having the passion, but that's just not the passion anymore. But you certainly brought that over the last 5 years with the strategic depth and calling people out on certain things and making us more aware of not only the game mechanics, but how we are presenting our arguments and helping generate some lively conversations, particularly between yourself and another regular co-host over the last 5 years. I can't possibly think who that individual is, but maybe it'll come to me after the record.
Yeah.
Of course it's Mackie. I mean, being the only woman on the internet does kind of lend itself to controversy, so it makes sense that that's the person you would butt.
Oh, I thought it was just because between he and I, there's like 1,000% more your mom jokes. We added more mom to your podcast.
We've always been referring to Masters of Magic. Nothing else.
Yeah, I don't know why everybody thinks it's something else.
It's your Masters of Magic.
Matt, your first actually appearance on the show was as a guest in December of 2010, episode 107. Wow.
Crazy.
You are also, other than myself, Mackie, and Phil, the most... I was going to say the most regular of co-hosts. I'm sorry.
Well, I certainly hope he's regular. I mean,
I don't know that to be true. I don't need to know that, but, you know, fiber is important. No.
The most regular of co-hosts.
Uh-huh. That's something we need.
That will be remembered as.
I'll get that printed on a t-shirt. It's in the mail, Matt. It's in the mail.
Okay.
You're looking at about 131 episodes that you appeared as a regular co-host on, which is more than double the next person who was a regular co-host and no longer is, and that was Imran Siddiqui at 56 episodes. And I know you had joked at one point that you couldn't possibly make it to 100 episodes. You were going to have to leave after 99, but... But I will say elsewise, since we're talking about some spreadsheet gargling here, and it does the throat good.
Damn, I knew I shouldn't have told you where your top 10 lists were.
It's actually not a top 10 list.
No, it's stats, the next best thing. It's air quotes.
That is true. 7 years and 11 months. That is how long Mackie, Phil, and I have been regular co-hosts on this show. As Phil's been on this show since January of 2010.
God.
Are you celebrating, Phil? Is that what you're doing? Is that what you're celebrating?
Yeah. It's fantastic. It's the best thing ever. Yeah,
listeners, we totally don't have that 1,000-year stare going, oh, God, that long?
Yes, it's fantastic because we're a fan podcast. All right.
Don't make me bring the Mackie fan into this.
She'll do it, too. She'll do it whether you want it or not.
He'll do it whether I want it or not.
Oh, yeah.
Mike W. wants to know in the chat, is Madgen leaving because Dan got engaged? Well, that's not really something we talk about publicly. But...
Oh,
Dan,
let it
your
life's
over. Doesn't mean it has to spill over into...
Well, even though civilization never ends, this podcast does have to at some point.
What?
Totally.
Nonsense.
Outrageous, I say.
This has been Polycast episode 295. I'm Mega Bears fan with your regular host, Dan Q.
Old school.
Makalua.
You come from the school of old?
The Meehan team.
Always bringing you the most tasteful of tactics.
And Mad Jin.
I still remember where the bodies are buried.
The bears or the bodies?
I almost said I almost remember where I buried the bodies, but that sounded worse.
Well, some of the bodies are bears, to be fair, so I can understand why that would get confusing. You just have to throw those parts in there just to cover other things up, to throw people off, you know.
Yeah.
Canadian things, we got to bury the bears as well as the bodies.
There is one more Polycast production to be recorded for the 2017 Christmas special, but until then,
get out.
One last time.
Matt, just thinking this is probably the last time I'm going to be able to say this because there's no way Dan's ever going to invite me back. So, well, I will also borrow a page from Imagine's book and say, bye, everybody.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
Record date?
November 25th, 2017.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.